This is Neil Rockhind. I'm the host of the Killer Cross-Examination podcast. And week in and week out, we feature some of the very best criminal defense lawyers, very best civil trial lawyers anywhere in the country. We pick their brains. We talk about war stories. If you like the content, subscribe and like. We've got thousands upon thousands of views on our YouTube videos. We've got thousands of listens and likes and shares on the podcast, which you can get on any platform, anywhere where you get your podcasts. And today is no exception. I've got an incredible guest, Jerry Goldstein from San Antonio, Texas. Jerry, welcome to the Killer Cross-Examination podcast, my friend. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Neil, and thank you for those kind lies.
You probably rehearse that line when everybody says anything nice about you, right?
Well, usually, and they usually are, but you were particularly nice. Thank you.
Jerry, tell me about your career. How did you get into criminal defense? How did you get into trials? Walk me through that, please.
Well, my dad was a lawyer. My mother wanted me to be an artist. I was an art history major at Tulane. That was because early 1961, Tulane was boys, Newcomb was girls. I went to Brown for a couple of days, an all boys school, and I'd never been to Providence, Rhode Island. In those days, you didn't go check anything out. And I took a train, which was the popular means of transportation back then, to New Orleans, where I knew I could have a good time. My father thought he paid for matriculation, not an education. And I really had no interest in the law, but I got out of college in 1965. The war was raging overseas. Students were rioting in the streets at home. I went to law school because it gave me a draft deferment. I'd gotten a notice from draft board number 9. There was my turn to kill or be killed. And I went to law school because I was a chicken shit. I wanted to stay out of the war.
Okay. That's an honest assessment.
Yeah. Well, it's true, honest or not. And I had no idea how much I was going to love it. I got out of law school in 1968, and it was really in turmoil. I loved law school. I did fairly well. I mean, I was hired by the University of Texas as faculty and taught there for almost 19 years. I'm still teaching at a law school here in San Antonio at St. Mary's. But what I learned about law schools is that many of them, like Texas, didn't look at your transcripts when they hired faculty. That was the first good thing. But I was interested in criminal law. It fascinated me. That was back, you know, the Warren Court was blazing. We had I met my bride, who you've met, of 54 years. We bought a Volkswagen bus. We pulled the seats out, put a Persian carpet down, little pillows, big peace symbol on the back, Ramsey Clark for president on the back bumper. We got run out of more South Texas counties than we got invited back to. And I was representing conscience objector, Dodgers, kids with one joint. We had 13 people in Texas serving life imprisonment for one joint. Wow. 13. And I met a wonderful lawyer by the name of Maury Maverick Jr. Wonderful. And that's a story in itself. Someday we ought to talk about it. He was my patron saint and my mentor, and he took me all over the country. His father was a congressman. He was a congressman. He introduced me to Justice Blackmun. My first case, they sent me to help Bill Kunstler with the lawyers who Judge Hoffman, with the appeal for the lawyers who Judge Hoffman had held in contempt in the Chicago 7 trial. So I met Jerry Lefkowitz, Michael Kennedy, Michael Tiger.
These are Roberts. Those are giants.
And by the way, that's how, I mean, I lucked out. I mean, it was a great time. And I had more fun being a trial lawyer. You know, I'm right at 80 years old now. I still get 100 days of skiing in, but I'm still trying cases. I'm still having fun. It's theater in a way, but it's street theater. You know, it's you've got the characters, you know what the story is, but it, nobody gives you a script. You get to play it out. And I'm particularly happy when there are good lawyers in the courtroom with me. You know, and you play tit for tat. I've seen you before.
You mentioned that as though there are lawyers who may not want to be in the courtroom with other good lawyers.
Well, I'm not saying I enjoy the moment. Nobody likes getting beat up, mm-hmm. but I think we're at our best when we're challenged. Mm-hmm. And you know, we can talk about cross-examination all we want, but preparation is what goes in, what makes a good trial lawyer, what a good advocate. And if you're prepared, you know, you could probably try the case to each other. Both sides have a good idea of what's going on. I mean, I'll be honest with you. If I had my way, most criminal defense lawyers would disagree with me and even hate me. And, you know, we revolutionized the Texas discovery practice with the Michael Martin case, which resulted in probably the most enlightened discovery, state discovery rules in the country. And we got in a lot of arguments about this, but if I had my way, I probably would agree to open discovery. I good civil lawyers, they have what do we not have? We try by ambush. We don't have depositions in most states. We don't have a request for admissions. We don't have interrogatories. You try the case basically blind. And other than Brady, which, you know, is pretty tough in a lot of instances, you really don't understand. And by the way, half the time I'd like to see what bad shit they've got, you know, about my client, as much as I want to have the good stuff. You know, and I, you know, some of the most important discovery in criminal cases around the country happens at trial. Oh shit, I didn't know they had that, you know. And if you ask your witness, he'll never testify against me. We're brothers, you know, right? I mean, how many times have we all heard that?
Yeah, guy's the first one on the witness stand. So
yeah, usually.
Hey, Jerry, let me ask you, Hunter Thompson. So much comes to mind when you're talking to me, but Hunter Thompson was a client of yours, and I think someone that you were close friends with. If I,
I'm guilty. That's true.
Tell me about that relationship. And the reason I say that is that Hunter Thompson, I think, once wrote an article or described you as the maestro of cross-examination or the.
By the way, he was very gracious to me. I represented him in three cases, but there were other wonderful lawyers, Hal Haddon out of Denver, Saskia Jordan and his firm. You know, I get to take credit for their hard work. But at the end of each case, he would let me write the this is one, Songs of the Doom. By the way, he would write books at the end of each case, and he would then let me write the last chapter. This is one, and this is the finding. It says final analysis, and Gerald Goldstein Esquire, and actually has our letterhead and everything, and it's a letter from me to him because I would brag about him. But the truth of the matter is, we had fun. One trial they brought in Ralph Steadman, you know, the wonderful illustrator that illustrated all of Hunter's books with the splotches and all that stuff. And Aspen still has two newspapers, believe it or not. But one of the Daily News, I got to cross-examine the cop. And, you know, nobody enjoys something more than that. And and by the way, I promise the judges there, I don't urinate my playpen. My father taught me better. So I don't try cases in small town. They got plenty of good lawyers. They don't need me coming in. But Hunter Thompson, a couple of other folks on occasion, but basically I don't they don't need me to practice law there. But one of the newspapers says the front page of Friday, August 30th, this is 1996, Tom Aspen cop grilled by Thompson lawyer. That's me. Thompson's lawyers go on shark hunt. The Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson's hearing on his charges Thursday turned into an inquisition of his arresting officer. And they even had, you can't see it, but it's a, they had a, Ralph Steadman came and he had an illustration of me on one side and Officer Glidden, and it was Maestro, me with a baton. It's not a very flattering caricature. Steadman wasn't very good at that, but and it had, it calls the Hidden Glidden, and it says Thompson's attorney Jerry Goldstein, I'm in that, you know, raked Glidden over the coals, leaving him by the end of the day, according to one reporter's account, not quite certain how to spell his own name. I was, you know, fuck, I kicked ass. I was so happy. And the next morning I lost that hearing. And I learned two things. One, never believe your own press. And two, if you're going to win one day of a two-day hearing, always try and make it the second day. Mm-hmm. But we did win the case. And I did get to write another last chapter.
Would you tell me something? So something strikes me. I mean, you're very eloquent. Yeah. Now you are. You're colorful. You're certainly have character. You're smart. I've seen you work up close in a case.
That was fun.
It was fun. Your mother, you said, wanted you to end up being an artist, and you ended up going to law school. But it seems as though, in some ways, you there is an artistry to what you do in court.
Well, there's certainly courtroom is theatrical, but you know, it comes in all shapes and colors. And you see that when you look at the media, when you look at movies, when you look at television, and today on the, you know, the digital internet, you know, some, you know, I wear a, you know, a sincere blue suit, and I dress up, you know, trying to impress people. And that's one thing. And, you know, look at Jerry Spence. I mean, he's got this, you know, bolo tie and fringe on his jackets and shit. And Tony Serra, you know, he had hair down to his tushy. You know, he usually wore a dashiki. You know, everybody's got their own shtick. You got to be yourself. And I think we can steal from each other. And God knows there are no original thoughts, particularly not in the law. Mm-hmm. I think we've all, you know, you learn by experience. You know, I've been doing this 55 years. A lot of this shit, you know, you've made enough mistakes where you wanted the earth to open up and you could disappear. You know, and on all our walls are all the cases where you've seen it. We've won. And Michael Tiger, a wonderful lawyer, still alive. He once came in and said, Goldstein is pretty impressive. But, you know, if you put up articles about all the cases you lost, you'd need three more buildings. and the Maury Maverick, who I was mentioning to you, and we are going to get to him at some point. I'm going to come back and do him because he told me this is my mentor. In 1968, when I started practicing, he said, you know, Goldstein, you want to be a criminal lawyer? Practicing criminal law is a lot like the old hen in the hen yard. Peck, 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 all over the hen yard. Every 100 pecks, she comes up with a kernel of corn. The other 99 times, she gets a mouthful of shit. Mm. And that's really, you know, what we do day in and day out. It's not like watching paint dry, but we wade through a lot of shit. Yeah. But we do it for those kernels of corn. We do it for those moments. And like, I guess, childbirth, you don't remember all the pain and all the shit you had to wait.
Right.
What you remember are those wonderful moments when truth comes out, when you actually uncover and dismantle some piece of shit who comes across as a badge bearing, you know, icon. And by the way, I've won cases because of honest law enforcement. I'm not castigating every law enforcement officer, but you know, it becomes a competition. I did spend a semester at the University of London in law school, and you know, we were honorary members of Lincoln's Inn. I'd go there for lunch, and you see all these robe characters with the, you know, with the wigs and shit. And one day they would be Queen's Counsel, I guess now King's Counsel, and the next day they'd be defense. And I think collegiality is important. Some of my best friends, I get in heated battles with them, but they, I respect them. I teach a course now at St. Mary's Law School with the former U.S. attorney who is still the chief of staff in the U.S. attorney's office. He'd been a prosecutor all his life, and I've been defending people for 55 years. But, you know, I don't like arguing cases. I actually argued a Supreme Court case with him, but mainly in the Fifth Circuit. But, you know, he's so straight and so knowledgeable and so under, you know, my life is an overstatement. You know, it's anyway, this guy understates everything. But it's as though when you're arguing a case and on appeal against him, it's like his argument is chiseled in stone and Moses just drug it down from the mount and handed it to him. You know, I think credibility is critically important, and particularly in cross-examination. The jury, it's not they've got to like you, they got to believe you. And if they believe you, then you're telling them a story.
They can like you, but not believe you, right?
And that will help you.
Right, right. So
yeah.
Tell me so you've been involved in some really significant and controversial cases, I guess. I know at one point were you involved in the... what's the acronym? Is it the FL? Is it
FLDS?
Yeah. Tell me about your involvement in that and what that was like.
Let's put it in the interesting to exotic category. I actually found them very interesting people. It was a religious sect, and you don't have to agree with everything, but you know, they lived a very interesting life. It was very communal. I guess that goes without saying. Mm-hmm. But they like many Mormons, they took life seriously, and they were very loyal to one another. And for example, you know, you look at their clothing. They made their own clothing. They had, it looked like my wife called it Target, but it looked like a Walmart. It was a big store on their property. And the sign as you walked in was, take what you need, not what you want. And you walked in and they had like five different kinds of washing machines and sewing machines and stoves and ovens. They lived a very modest lifestyle. But, you know, I'm an aging hippie. You know, I got out of law school in the late 60s. There's something to that lifestyle. I mean, I've fallen prey to greed like everybody else, but I think, you know, we all could have made a lot more money doing something else. And I cherish the lifestyle that, as an aging hippie, I learned in the 60s.
What was the case about, and what was your role in it?
The case was alleged that they all participated and sexual assaults of children, of underage females. I was the lead counsel that, by the way, you want to talk about what goes on our border under Trump. Think about this. They took hundreds, I think it was over 300 children away from their parents. And the family law issues were staggering in the case, you know, about under what circumstances, you know, and do you just generically just rip if they were faithful to the faith, did they not warrant having children? I mean, how did you make those decisions, which are normally made on an individual basis? They had a hearing and they had to use the auditorium. in this town. And the town where their temple was, which was made out of marble, and it was twice the size of the county courthouse. It was a pretty impressive place. Well, they had to conduct the hearing in a nearby larger town, San Angelo, in their convention center, just to house all the lawyers. It took two and a half hours just to seat the lawyers. And you know, how are they going to give individual attention to the well-being of every one of the kids? Anyway, that was what the case was about. And we had some wonderful, you know, you talk about particularized information about the place to be searched and the items or persons to be seized. They had no idea. They just went in there and shut the whole place down. And you talk about a general warrant. And so we had some really interesting issues, but their patron saint, who was in jail in Utah, when they moved him to Texas to be prosecuted, by the way, they considered all non-FLDS members Gentiles. I was a Gentile. I'd never been called that before, but apparently that's a dirty word. And he fired me when he realized I was Jewish. And the issue became, how are they going to expunge my knowledge of their sacred scrolls, which I was using at least nominally in some of the arguments. It was fun. I got fired just in time not to have to suffer the indignity of trying these cases, which they tried ad seratum, putting people in jail for long periods of time. I'm talking about, you know, 70-year-old, one person was 80 something years old, and they put him in jail for 20 years. I'm not Willie Nelson, who just had his 90th birthday, who I had the pleasure of representing. I got to just tell you about Willie.
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
Well, he was busted in Louisiana in the bus, and Billy Rittenberg ended up helping him. But when they busted him, the deputy sheriff, this is in the deputy's report, he says, I found a shoebox, and I brought it to him, and I said, this appears to be marijuana. And in his report, he says, Mr. Nelson responded, it was during the E. coli scare, and he said, thank God it's not spinach. And Willie ended up doing a concert for a federal institution that had been suffered a flood. Sorry about that.
No problem.
It's
got to be pretty amazing to you to think about the span of your career, going back to Willie Nelson and a question about marijuana on a bus.
I was going to tell you that with respect to the FLDS, and then we'll get off of that. Remember, Willie said, I think a few years ago, he said, I never thought I'd outlive my pecker. But an 80-year-old is not a danger to young children. I know that from life experience. But thank you for the compliment. Look, I've had...
You were practicing law when there were people in Texas who were serving life sentences for a joint.
Yep.
You know, marijuana legalization is on the ballot every year or two in another state.
And by the way, don't forget Keith Stropp, who started Normal. That's how I met Hunter Thompson. I was on the first board in 1970. Keith Stropp, who became a law partner of mine, and I represented him in that notorious Canadian case. But what a wonderful guy. I'm going to see him next week in Denver. He's still... is active in the reform movement. And he tricked me early on into standing up and telling the truth. We had amazing fun back in the 60s, but it mainly fell upon minorities and poor people. In Texas, the Hispanics. But we had one kid, it was actually a white kid. We had what we call the bitch, the habitual statute. And if you got three felonies, you got sentenced to life without prison automatically without any sentencing or punishment hearing once you were found guilty. And there was a guy named Thomas Mistrot, M-I-S-T-R-O-T. And he was serving a life sentence for one joint. And it was during a period of time when the Texas vending machine lobby was very strong. And so his first felony was breaking into a Coke machine. His second felony was breaking into a into a parking meter. All right. And his third felony was a marijuana joint. And the Playboy Foundation.
I mean, these are petty offenses. I mean, these are petty minor offenses. Can you
imagine? Can you imagine serving life in Senate in prison? And the Playboy Foundation actually funded us, and we ultimately got the law changed, and he was freed. And I still
you've been active in Normal, and have actually, I think, given their lifetime achievement or bestowed an incredible honor. You've been at I think you were an NACDL. Were you a past president, or you were a?
I am.
And you've been given a lifetime achievement award there.
Outstanding lawyer in the country, the Haney Award. I was the past president, but you know, if you practice law for 55 years, you're going to find some kernels of corn. You're going to get some awards. Everybody will. I know you have. And they're wonderful, but it's tomorrow that matters. And I think, you know, as long as we're still active and still, you know, there's going to, I hate to say this, I don't want to scare you, Neil, but I can see the end of the tunnel. You know, I'm hoping it's that bright light is an opening and not a train coming in my direction. But, you know, at some point, when you're a kid or young, you know, you worry about death. And when you're 80 years old, look, it's going to come. I mean, it's not just inevitable, but you've got less time left than you've been here. And you just take it in stride, and it's made my religion of faith has turned into hedonism, not in the bizarre kind, but I mean, I can't do much about what happened yesterday, and there's only a little bit I can do about tomorrow, but I can do something right now today, and that's why I'm with you. You know, make a difference. Something, make this place a better place, and what you do today, you're not going to regret tomorrow. And I think most of us have been blessed with a wonderful opportunity to make a difference, and that's one of the things when I was a little hippie in law school, with no shoes on. You know, I remember, you know, in those big arenas, and you'd hang your feet in the. We only had two women in the class of 100 and something, but my feet obviously needed a bath, and the woman in front of me finally asked to be moved because nobody above her had shoes on. But it was 1965, 66, and there was something, and you know, that draft notice, Maury Maverick always said, Goldstein, you didn't have a conscience until you got that draft notice, and you were sitting on your conscience, and he's right. And I think national service is something we all ought to give some thought to, just to give people an opportunity to see what it's like. My dad used to make me work in service industry. You know, he said, you know, you spend some time, I don't care whether it's selling shoes or waiting tables or being a barback, but you'll learn more about people by serving them than you'll ever learn by being serviced. And he was right. And that instinctive, it's what's good about cross-examination, is what's good about understanding how to pick jurors. Is it perfect? No, nothing's perfect. But, you know, when you look out there at our public, look, if we're going to do anything with the next administration, we better spend some money on education. People are buying into some strange bullshit. And I think it doesn't say much about our education system if they're going to buy into some of this stuff they're fed.
I'm glad you're going there, because things are different now than they were facts aren't facts. There's, you know,
thank you.
People have, we used to be able to argue about the law, and you could argue about the subtlety. Do you see things from this direction or that direction? You could argue about perspective, but now people have their own facts.
And they've got this technology, this digital technology that allows them to create these images. I mean, mm-hmm. It used to be, remember there was that ad for audio tape? You know, is it real or is it?
Is it whatever? Live or is it Memorex?
Yeah. And Memorex. Well, now, by the way, they've got AI that now they opened a Senate hearing the other day with the chair actually using it to show there's an app you can buy. And if they have 7 to 10 minutes of your conversation, and by the way, it not only can mimic your thoughts, it uses your inflection, and you will, and I think they're going to get it to where even technology can't tell the difference between, well, what are we going to do when that happens? What are we going to do in, you know, when, is it live or is it Memorex? Or can we tell?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you.
Yeah, sorry.
No.
I think the truth.
These are important points.
The truth and facts now have a half-life. I mean, they, you know, it until somebody decides differently. And,
These are really important points. I tried a case several years ago in which there was an issue about a recording, and did our clients, who were public officials, did they say a certain thing that this gadfly who was trying to get them in trouble, did they say this? Did they not say that? And we brought in experts and these different guys from all over. And the issue was with the quality of the recording, and was it spliced and was it copied? And then it got to the point where in the end, it turns out that, you know, and this was years ago, where you couldn't replicate somebody's voice, but AI now you can. And then I learned during that case that if it's a copy, a digital copy, there's actually no, like, there's no original.
Right.
Like, you record it, there's no original. It's not like you have a tape that you can just, in the old days, there's no tape to splice.
And by the way, remember when we used to have law books?
Yes.
I mean, by the way, it's all, and, you know, I worry sometime. I hope this is an actual legal public. Remember when you had to shepherdize? I still remember back in 1965, and I would have a whole table at the library, and I would have the big red book, then I have the little red book, then the little red pamphlet, and then the yellow book, and then the black and white book. And you know, you had to have perfect eyes or a magnifying glass to go with it. And if your finger didn't go across it just right, you got the wrong case. And I'll be honest with you, I can't tell you how many nights I spent. And I think being a good lawyer not only takes the ability to be active and to be on your feet and to be like a linebacker with your feet hip width apart and be ready to respond, but it requires not just preparation, but hard work.
I want to know, how do you prepare for a cross-examination now, as opposed to how you prepared 30 or 40 years ago?
It's actually, it's different, but it's the same. What you, generally speaking, I think in cross-examination, is so hard with digital, but you now, you can cleverly, I've seen you use PowerPoint. And just as we were able to change and do it effectively and be able to turn a black and white page into something that spoke words that we wanted to emphasize, and you're able to do that, but AI and algorithms allow us to find things that in the old days we couldn't. But in the old days, what you were looking for, you know, cross-examining someone, one of the most effective cross-examinations is impeaching with a prior inconsistent statement. And I think there is a mantra, there's an art, a skill that you can develop, but we'll talk about that some other time or later. But you've got to find the raw material. You got to find that report that somebody wrote and signed where they said something different. You've got to find that transcript where at a bail hearing or at sentencing, a co-defendant said something much different in their allocution mm-hmm. or in their bail hearing that they don't, people don't testify normally these days, but when they were trying to get out of jail, and that was always kind of interesting, because that when they were, they're not there to help you. They're spring loaded to try and shit on you, because the more they assist the prosecution in federal court, it was codified into the guidelines, but it was always true. You paid rent for the courtroom, and the reward you got was somewhat dependent upon how effective you were as a witness. And that desire to curry favor with the prosecution is something that I think you developed that really well, but you got to be able to find the material to mm-hmm. do that with. And today, you know, I've always said that the biggest oxymoron I know is the warning that you get in computer wording about protecting the content from children. Shit. I mean, you and I both know, I've got a 33-year-old, but in our household, when your computer was fighting with you, you needed a 15-year-old to come do it. I mean, the idea that they weren't going to be able to get around it, you needed them to get into it, much less being able to keep them out of it. And, you know, look at them. And by the way, COVID really made us a little bit that way. But look at these kids. Leave a message for them on their voicemail, and they'll never see it. They'll go to their grave with that still there.
Ask them, if it's
but they're texting each other constantly.
And if you asked them, what is a, if you held up a cell phone and said, what is this used for? In the top four or five answers, they won't say talking.
Of course not. And Billy, and think about it. It's become an extension. What was it in Riley that the Chief Justice in that unanimous opinion said, we've got, what, 356 million people? We've got 1.5 times that many cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an extension of their bodies. They're constantly looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself doing a lot, you know, if we had done that at the dinner table back in the 50s when I was in high school, my mother would have, you know, she would have ripped it up. You know, we were lucky to be able to go to that little television set after dinner. They're constantly on it, and they're constantly communicating. They're constantly receiving information. But that is a source of prior and consistent statements. And if you're clever with that technology, you're able to use it. Because in the old days, you know, there was a mantra. You know, Your Honor, may I approach the witness? You know, I show you what's been marked Defendant's Exhibit A. Is that your signature? Well, it looks like it. Well, that's great. Let's argue about whether you know what your mm-hmm. signature looks like for a half an hour. That's better than talking about my client's familiarity with the unfortunate facts of the case. It's a transcript. And, you know, those little numbers on the side, it is like Moses chiseled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do you remember testifying in a courtroom like this before a judge 2 years ago on October 25th? Well, yes, sir. And did you take an oath just like you did before this jury? You learned those little steps. Was it the same oath that you took here before this jury? Did you swear to God that you would tell the truth, the whole truth, you know, and nothing but the truth? Yeah. And, well, do you remember uttering these words? Well, if it says I did, well, let's argue about the credibility of the court reporter. That's better. You know, right. So you have that. Well, but you can kind of do that with our new digital, but you got to be very clever about it. And the courts are starting to get savvy. I mean, it's like if we use the PowerPoint simple, you know, which you and I are adept at in your opening or closing, I've got, particularly in federal court, I've got judges, and they want to see it before you put it up there. And, you know, I don't know what I'm going to say before, you know, you've mm-hmm. got the PowerPoint, I've seen you playing with it. Well, I'm not sure which ones I want to use.
Right.
Right. Can I do it ex parte? No, I want to see, I want both of y'all to show each other what you're going to do. I want, you know, and it's like, we don't get to see each other's closing argument before we make them.
Right.
Yeah, but this is different. It's more influential, you know, it's 403. It's, you know, more prejudicial than probative. What do you mean? The fact that I put up a transcript of what that piece of shit said? That's prejudicial. Well, maybe to him, but you know.
Oh my God. Some of these arguments are the things that I've literally, you know, sat there and, you know, and I don't have a PowerPoint. And I know some guys in the middle of, like, they're so adept at it that when the prosecution is up doing their thing, they're creating like a PowerPoint. They're creating things to use while they're, because they're listening.
And you know what, let me tell you how Rutterman, let's go back.
The thing about those judges,
they weren't trial lawyers.
They weren't. And there's a now departed, and may he rest in peace, one of the finest trial lawyers, one of the most eloquent speakers I've ever had the privilege to go up against and work with, was a man named Albert Hatchett here from Detroit, from Pontiac. He was absolutely.
I've heard of him. I didn't know him, but I've heard.
Spellbinding. You'd sit there and as a prosecutor, you'd sit there and he'd be, or representing a co-defendant, and he'd be up doing something, and you would just be doing this, looking at him. And also, just go, Mr. Rockine, yeah, it's your turn. You're like, oh, wait, I got to do something now? Like, I
mean, well, it's like a little Jewish kid in South Texas.
It was spellbinding.
Sunday morning, you know, listening to AM radio, and some Baptist, you know, Bible thumping preacher, and all of a sudden he's spellbinding, and you actually listen to something that you would never listen to otherwise. I think there are those rare folks, but
Albert once said about a judge, he said he for years sought the refuge of the bench. He sought the bench like a refuge from the practice of law. And then he got there, and then within a second turned around and looked at us as though he had made the greatest sacrifice to give up the greatest career that would have been the most promising career since Darrow, just to dispense wisdom. And every argument he'd have, he could resolve the greatest, most significant problems within 30 seconds. Well, and I knew exactly. And when Albert told me that story, I knew he was talking about one person, I believed. And then it turns out that I think he was probably talking about, he was foreshadowing some years to come. So,
well, by the way, a lawyer sent me a quote the other day, and it said, what do you call a lawyer who over time continually demonstrates a lack of knowledge of the law?
Oh, no.
Your Honor. Oh. Yeah.
Jerry, I got to ask you some questions. So I got to fire off some questions here because I'm having too good of a time talking to you. Because you're such a good person. I hope that in this discussion, it's clear to our subscribers and listeners what a wonderful human being you are. And I mean that because even.
Very kind.
You and I know, but it's true. We could go a year or two, which I hope doesn't happen, without speaking. And 35 to 40 seconds on the phone with you, and I feel as though we've had a continuous running conversation in which you're up to date on the important things in my life. And that's a gift. That is a gift that you have.
We shared each other's gifts. So in a case over a period of years.
Yes.
And I can't tell you.
No.
The feeling goes both ways.
All right. Tell me the thing. Who's the, besides you, I know, and this is an easy one. First of all, people should know that you're blessed to also partner with Cynthia Orr, who's one of the finest lawyers in the country as well. And I also think a past president of the national, from the NAC.
And the past chair of the ABA's criminal justice section. And she's going in 2 weeks to the next Guantanamo hearing as a UN observer, which she's done three times in the past. Thank you for that. And
amazing.
She'll appreciate that.
So apart from your partner, because it would be easy, and I know that if I asked, you probably would, of course, not just out of loyalty or fidelity, you would identify her as a fantastic trial lawyer, because she is that good. But who's the best outside of your firm, over the course of your career, who's the best cross-examiner you think you've seen, the one that made the most and lasting impression on you?
Well, there were two. One is Michael Tiger, who I mentioned to you, and he's got a technique exactly the opposite of what I do. I mean, totally 180 degrees.
Explain, please.
Tiger's approach is, my approach is, to give you an idea, is you're the storyteller. That witness is just a beacon that you're bouncing your ideas. That's why they call them leading questions. You're telling them what the answer is, and it doesn't actually matter. They'll put a question mark at the end of it. Isn't it a fact that, and you make the statement, they can do whatever they want to, you know, or that's not true. By the way, it almost doesn't matter, because you, if you're good at it and you've taken the jury by the arm and shown them that you know what you're talking about, and that every time this lying sack of shit, you know, deviates from the thing, you're going to pull their nose and stick it in it. There was a wonderful judge named Suttle once who actually in the middle of a trial said, you know, Goldstein's got that answer. Why don't you just give it to him? Because it's getting late. We just need to move on. But I will tell you that my idea is you don't ask questions that you don't solidly understand the answer to. And you can tell that story a lot better than some hostile witness who's there to dump on your client. Tiger, on the other hand, believes, and we did a dueling cross-examination program one time for NACD, for the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in Washington, D.C. And his idea is, look, you lose the audience if you're the speaker. What you need is to have the witness give the testimony, and when they do it, it's much more meaningful. Well, you got to be really skillful. I mean, his idea is you build a box, you know, so wide and so tall, and you drop the little rat in it, and you then cut a little hole that, you know, and you make them run around until they finally figure out that's the only way they're getting out of the box, because you got them pinned in so many different ways. Well, there are probably a couple of people I've met. The other one was a wonderful lawyer from Texas, no longer with us, by the name of Warren Burnett. And he was one of those guys that came from Tennessee, but you could, it was like that preacher you run across, you know, from some northern Mexico station that didn't have to meet our FCC rules. And, you know, you could hear, you know, the big bopper coming from Del Rio, across the border from Del Rio, Texas. He would stop you in your tracks, and they could spend a half an hour with a witness that you might spend 3 minutes on, because the witness, you know, I'm the kind of person that I know what I want. And when I finally get it from the witness, I will beat them to death with it and make my closing argument with it. Well, that might work with one witness, but by the time you do it with three, it gets kind of boring. And a dim light, even on a dumb prosecutor's forehead, will come on, and you'll get the witness to come, well, that's not actually true. And they'll explain to the jury why that wasn't true. Tiger was, and Warren, they could take a witness and make them tell the story the correct way. And that's an art that I think you're born with. I'm not sure you can keep that.
If there's a person alive, or I'll say anybody in history that you could cross-examine, who would it be?
Donald fucking Trump.
And why?
Because
I've had lawyers on here that have cross-examined Donald Trump and wish that they had another crack at it. So,
well, I don't doubt that. But, you know, when we were talking about having ammunition, this sucker loves to speak, and he does it in a recorded fashion. It's on, you know, there is so much material out there. I mean, you know, the your average, you know, witness to a barroom brawl in which somebody is shot and killed, you know, they come off pretty sympathetic. You know, they in South Texas, all of them were always in the bathroom, so they never found the witness. But, you know, if you got a witness that's not experienced, Donald Trump, I think, appears, you know, and I understand there are people that believe him regardless, but he's said so many different things about so many different subjects that he has created a fertile cross-examination preparation depository or repository that I would love to have all that ammunition and be able to, may I approach the witness, Your Honor? You know, that mantra, mm-hmm. I show you, you know, and he doesn't have the same advantage of that he would in another situation. I thought the deposition that they admitted at E. Jean Carroll's civil trial. By the way, she wrote a book about Hunter. In fact, she quotes me in it a couple of times. And I'll tell you off about Hunter's relationship with her. But I thought her lawyer did a nice job with Trump and got him, gave him just enough rope to go and hang himself with it. But and I don't care whether I win or not. I would just like to cram some of those answers down his throat and make him regurgitate them. Anyway,
do you ever have any? Are there any cross examinations that you look back at, or any moments in trials? Could be voir dire, opening, closing, where you finished and you said to yourself, "Now, that was a work of art. I just knocked that one out of the park."
Sure, but the more interesting ones are usually humorous, and you know, Maury Maverick, we were picking a jury in Deep Throat, which I went to the Supreme Court twice. Once they passed the attorney's fees award, we had sued the DA in San Antonio back at the time. It wasn't enough that it was a Class B misdemeanor. He decided he was running for office that he would indict it and try it as a felony for the use of a criminal instrument. But by the way, this was the first big foreign movie to go nationwide, and it was shown on a 60 millimeter projector. So they got some poor kid, he was my client, you know, who went to the Texas Employment Commission and, you know, "Do you have any skills?" "Well, I used to show, you know, the syphilis films in the boys' gymnasium," and they sent him up there. And so I had to pick a jury, and Maury said he would make me practice in front of a mirror, and I would ask questions like, "Mrs. McGillicuddy, if you saw a film where a woman gets off of a man and there is semen dripping out of the corner of her mouth, could you ever find that to have redeeming social value?" And he said, "You know you're going to strike Mrs. McGillicuddy, and so you're embarrassed. We want to look for some guy that smirks or smiles when you ask her that question. That's your keeper." So, you know, you learn things. And we've all had, we just tried a very large federal wire fraud case involving bribery. And both a state senator and a judge testified that they got $1 million from my client. His defense was, "Yes, but I did pay them that, but it was not for a bribe. It was, you know, for their services in this." He provided medical services for the federal private prisons that were housing mainly INS detainees. But in that case, they had a witness, and he had 15 years that he was a lawyer, and he had 15 years that he had failed to pay his income tax. And, you know, you can ask, "You didn't pay your income tax, did you? You know, you didn't pay it for 15 years, did you?" And by the way, that's effective, I guess. But I had the, you know, he said, I asked him the first question. I put up, you know, the date up on a big screen. I said, yeah. And I knew what the answer was because he had given testimony in a pretrial hearing. I said, is it true that you said you didn't pay your income tax because it was too difficult to compute your tax? It didn't matter what he answered, because I had his testimony, you know, the sworn testimony. You know, do you remember, you know? So I did the remember thing. And then I put the next year up. And, you know, and by the time I got to 10, you know, the prosecution, the judge, Mr. Goldstein, I want to go through each. I'm sorry, Judge, believe it or not, there's some more. I'm entitled to. And every one of those is a 5-year felony. And nobody's charged him with that. And I just want to know whether he's been given any promises. I'm in promising you. Doesn't matter what his answer is. And then you just keep on. And then in closing argument, you get to do it again. And, you know, I think sometimes repetition can be important, but sometimes it's the way you do it as much as the fact that you did it. Did he break down and say, I'm a lying sack of shit? No, but he was. And the jury acquitted this guy. Hey, and Jerry, he should have been acquitted, but you know. Anyway.
So Jerry, what's on deck for you? Where are you, if people wanted to find you, how would they reach you? How would they look up your website? Do you have an Instagram? Do you have a Twitter account? Do you have any of that stuff going on?
I don't, but we've got a website. I think it's a very good one. It's Goldstein and Orr. It's got a lot of good stuff about Cynthia on there and about every lawyer in our office. We now have 7 lawyers, and we've got 2 more coming on board after the exams, which is big for a criminal defense firm. But we have, you know, we've been blessed with, you know, a few kernels of corn, and and even if you don't succeed in the ultimate goal and you don't get an acquittal, there are so many different things you can do to service the client to make sure that we mitigate whatever punishment they're going to receive. I just think, and some of the best opportunities for examining witnesses is often at sentencing. You know, particularly in federal court, you know, where the probation officer prepares this report and it's based upon hearsay. It's the agent telling her, well, this is what so-and-so told me. And often it's what he told me they said. And so it's third hand hearsay. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times even judges get live testimony where they can actually look at somebody. And if you've got good evidence, and a lot of times you do, and we sort of just fall into this gutter ball and fail to take advantage of our skill set at a critical time, because 97% of your cases are pled because of the trial penalty, because going to trial with a 20-year minimum mandatory is just not an option. So you're going to, and by the way, there's a wonderful, the American College of Trial Lawyers, ACTL, that, you know, I'm blessed with being a fellow in it. They put out and by the way, most of the Supreme Court justices of the U.S. are in that club. They put out a white paper on why if 97% of the cases, the only meaningful day in court anyone has in most cases is at sentencing, is at punishment. Why in the world, if cross-examination is the crucible by which we're going to decide the veracity, why are we deciding that critical issue based upon hearsay? Why isn't confrontation critical at the punishment stage, at your sentencing? And I think that's an issue that one of the lawyers listening to this, I'm too old to get it done, but I think we're going to finally get there, because if that's how we're going to end up resolving most of these criminal cases, we need to have a meaningful hearing if that's the only hearing people are going to get.
Well, I hope someone out there is listening, and I hope that happens. So,
me too.
Hey, Jerry, it has been great to have you on the Killer Cross-Examination podcast. I know I could talk to you for hours. I do want to arrange for you to come back
I would and love
to talk about is Maury Maverick. I think that's a be an absolutely incredible, just devote a podcast episode to just you kind of talking about him and the things, his sayings, the things he taught you. It sounds like he made such an incredible impression on you that
he did. Even and not just on me, on everybody.
So
have you, Neil, in a different way.
Well, in a different way. Of course, in a different way. Hey, again, this is Neil Rockine. This is the Killer Cross-Examination Podcast. My good friend Jerry Goldstein was my guest. He's one of the best out there. This podcast will be released soon. Look for it on our website. Look for it on YouTube. You can find him at goldsteinandor.com, I think. Is that right? Is it goldsteinandor.com? And believe it or not, he's one of those guys where you could just Google his name, Gerald Goldstein, and you're going to get more information about him than he probably knows is out there. But there's a ton of it, and it's all
positive.
And believe it all, because it's all true. And he's probably edited a lot of it out to take out all the really fun stuff. But he's a wonderful human being and a great lawyer and a great person and deserves every accolade he gets. So, Jerry, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I can't wait to release it, and I'll certainly let you know when we do. Again, stay cool, and thanks, man. You're the best.
Thank you.